This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. James Woods has played his share of tough guys. He was a cop killer in the Onion Field, a fearless and sometimes foolish journalist in Salvador, and a gangster in Once Upon a Time in America. Now he's playing a career criminal in the new movie Another Day in Paradise. It's based on the semi-autobiographical novel by Eddie Little and is directed by Larry Clark, who also directed the film Kids. Woods plays Mel, a pro who becomes a mentor for Bobby, a rookie thief played by Vincent Kartheiser. In this scene, Mel, the veteran, is beginning to take the kid under his wing. They're in Mel's car.
How old are you?
Old enough.
Hey, why don't you say the tough guy routine for people you might actually scare, okay? I'm not putting you down. I'm merely trying to make a point. Bobby, I don't know how old you are, right? But I'm going to bet you money that you got a driver's license says you're 18 or 19, and I'll give you 10 to 1 it's off by 2 or 3 years, okay? You're doing dope all day, and you're stealing with both hands. Here's my point. You think you're a thief. Do you know what you are? You're a f***ing bust waiting to happen. A pro, okay, only steals when he knows everything's in his favor, when he f***ing knows he's not going to get caught. And there are only a few really true professionals around, and guess what? They don't do dope. Because, see, eventually the drugs are going to make you f*** up. And booyah, you're in the penitentiary. The thing is, for guys like us, you just try to make that run as good and as long as you can before it's over, which it will inevitably f***ing be. That's my point. So, how old are you?
Old enough.
Good answer. Never plead guilty. Ah, man, tough guy.
You play Mel with a lot of charm at the beginning of the film. I mean, he really takes this younger thief under his wing and helps repair him physically, helps him get more money, gives him a kind of surrogate family. The charm starts to fade after a while. But describe how you saw this character of Mel.
Well, it was an issue that I am fascinated by, which is the equation between charm, as you say, and rightfully so, and sociopathy. I mean, I have found in my rather voracious reading about many criminal types, whether they be in politics or in the world of petty crime, that oftentimes very charming people are in fact highly sociopathic. I mean, they use charm as a kind of negotiating ploy to lure people into their lives and into their circles and then kind of vampirize them for their own ends. And, I mean, we see it from the highest level of politics to the lowest level of street crime where, very charming people find a way to enlist compatriots in their worlds of crime.
You mentioned that you've done a lot of reading about sociopaths. Is that because you've played so many of them?
Well, in the process of playing them, but also, I mean, in the news, I'm always fascinated by those kind of offbeat stories. I mean, whether it's, politicians who pretend to care about a certain group of people, but then in fact sell them out, but keep smiling and using them as a political base, you know, to enhance their well-being and their positions of power, or the odd news item. I remember I was in Hawaii once, and there was a front page article when I was, in Oahu, and a guy who was a crisis manager at an anger institute. It was an institute for the management of anger. Had beaten the crap out of one of his clients. at some point, he just got fed up with the guy and beat him almost to death and ended up, putting the guy in the hospital. And he went to jail. And I just love the idea of an anger crisis management, guru beating up one of his clients. I mean, that kind of thing always fascinates me as an actor because I believe that people have by and large, you find that people are, engaged in chronic manic denial over who they really are. So they're always rationalizing or defending a position that, in fact, is usually the opposite of how they truly behave behind closed doors or in moments of when they don't feel they're being observed. And I think that there is a lot of hypocrisy in human nature in general, and it's something that as an actor I like to explore. So when you play a character like Mel in Another Day in Paradise, I love showing how charming and funny and kind of exuberant he is about life. And of course, that's very infectious to a young boy like the character of Bobby, who says, man, this is really the life. I'm with this guy in this cool car, and he's shooting heroin, and he's 50 years old, and he's still using and looking cool, and you know, has a lot of money from being a thief and so on. This is the life I want. And of course, you know, he's not prepared for the violence and the disillusionment that follow.
The movie Another Day in Paradise is based on an autobiographical novel by Eddie Little. So did you have a chance to talk with him while you were making the movie? I'm wondering if there are things you wanted to ask him about his memories of his crime mentor and what his life was like at the time.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, it's I don't know if you ever talked to recovering addicts, you know, and whether you're addicted to drugs or crime or the life, as it's called, there's always a kind of wistfulness that these people have about, you know, the fact that it was in some ways fun. And one of the things that, I know that sounds odd, but one of the things that we wanted to try to get across in Another Day in Paradise is the fact that this movie about petty crime and particularly, you know, heroin and speed addiction is that at the time you're involved in it, you know, it's a great ride. It's a joy ride. And most movies, you know, like Trainspotting and so on, you know, they come into the close-up of the needle going in the arm and the sinister music plays and, you know, it's an event. And in Larry Clark's pictures of that time in Tulsa, in the book Tulsa and in his time in Tulsa, Oklahoma, there was one photograph that particularly caught my attention. And it was like a lot of, you know, very attractive young men sitting around in this house and they're laughing. And, you know, it looked like a frat party, you know, at some college. But in fact, if you look closely, one of the guys is shooting up and sitting on the arm of the chair is a gun and so on. And you realize that these are just young men feeling exuberant who happen to be in a parallel universe to that which we as sort of, quote, normal, civilized, unquote, citizens, you know, live in. And I said to Larry, I said, man, it looked like it was so much fun. He said, man, it was a blast. It was just great, you know. And he said, I'll never say that it wasn't fun. It was fun. I said, by the way, where's this guy now? He said, he's dead. And how about that guy? Dead. How about that guy? He's in the penitentiary. I think he died. He's dead, you know. And you think, oh, nice picture. Good thing it's frozen in time because let me tell you, there's no future to it.
You also are a producer of Another Day in Paradise. Why did you want to produce the movie?
Well, when I came aboard, my partner Stephen Chen and Larry were having a hard time getting the picture financed, and my participation in it as an actor, of course, made that possible. But we really wanted to go for what we thought would be the full realization of the movie's potential, and I felt that having a, you know, that Mel and Sid, the woman that is his partner in crime and in life, should be very charismatic characters. And one of the reasons that you would do a film like this that, first of all, has a very documentary aura, which is its strength and it lends to the excitement for the audiences and the critics who have fallen in love with it, is the element of having a certain kind of star charisma, that these two people are stars to the two young kids, played by Vincent Kartheiser and Natasha Gregson-Wagner, who are wonderful young actors. And I came up with the idea of having Melanie Griffith be my co-star, because Melanie has a kind of, you know, ever-youthful sort of baby doll quality. And now the character is a woman who has really kind of hit 40 like a brick wall going 100 miles an hour. And Melanie had the courage to play the part that way, you know, a sort of, you know, fading Cupid doll. And we decided that having two sort of, I hate to use the word, but from a commercial point of view, stars playing that part made it intriguing to the young people, that these were two really flashy people that they could sort of go for. And as a producer, I was able, we had terrible time constraints because we did what's called gap financing, where you go to a bank, you say, we have this movie, we have this script, we have these elements, and we want to make this movie. And they go, great, you got to start shooting, you know, in 4 weeks, and you have to deliver the print in, say, 6 months or whatever. And so to go through the process of trying to get a star like Melanie Griffith, who had to get her agent to read the script, would have been unbearable because, you know, they'd wait a month and then say, oh, yeah, we had this script, but it's no good, blah, 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 you know, because they don't want their clients to work for the kind of money that we had to offer, which was virtually nothing. So I called Melanie personally and said, I think this is a part that can win you an Academy Award, and it's a great part. And, you know, actresses who are 40 and over oftentimes complain that there are no good parts because they often want to play parts where the character looks like she's 23. I said, this is a part where you're playing that horrible dilemma that faces, you know, glamorous women, And it's cruel, but it's a reality which they all acknowledge in this business, you know, where you're going to play her like a woman who is facing 40, you know, and she's a junkie and she's a thief and she's living with this guy who's, you know, really dangerous and so on. And her life is fading. And now all of a sudden she brings in this, you know, very young, beautiful girl into their sort of surrogate family. And she's got to face all that envy and kind of strange sort of mother-daughter thing that goes on. And Melanie says, man, it sounds like a great part. And as a producer, I offered her half my star salary and half my participation in the picture to get her aboard. And so, you know, I was able as a producer to be able to use that power to get her in. And as an actor, you know, as the star of the picture, to be able to use the money I was getting to also to make it possible for her to participate financially without taking a terrible loss, you know, mm-hmm. because, you know, the constraints are very limited.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Woods. He stars in the new film Another Day in Paradise. He's also a producer of the film. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Woods. His new film is called Another Day in Paradise. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about the role that I think of as your breakthrough role in movies. And this was in the film The Onion Field, where you played
right.
a sociopathic killer. Your character, Greg Powell, was a small-time thief who thought of himself as a brilliant master criminal. And he and his nervous partner ended up abducting two cops and killing one of them after
right.
they stopped these two guys on the road. I want to play a clip from The Onion Field. In this scene, your character, Greg, and his partner, Jimmy, are on a robbery spree. They're laying over at a motel. And after your character, Greg, has had very noisy sex with his girlfriend in the motel, he comes out to the parking lot to talk to his partner, Jimmy.
We're going back to L.A.
L.A.? Jumping Jesus. One night in Las Vegas, one night in Bakersfield.
Jimmy. Now, Jimmy, we're doing okay. We bought us this cherry little hot rod, didn't we? You bought us some nice presents. And we had us some fun, didn't we?
Fun? Like I got to lose 10 nickels in the damn slot machine. Greg, the last thing you said, we was going to Frisco. L.A. is a two-hour drive in the wrong direction. We moving around like damn gypsies.
Jimbo, you just don't understand. We are going to Frisco, but first we got to go to L.A. and get us some money by pulling another little job there so we can go to Frisco. You understand? Now we're just going to leave the wagon here, and we'll be back by midnight. Okay? Now, what you got to do is remind me to get the brake lights fixed on that coupe, because we can't get stopped by the cops for faulty brake light. Now can we, huh? So me and my little honey buns got you stirred up there, did we? You know, I'm kind of a virtuoso sexually. That means that I'm a master at pleasing women.
She says that she can never imagine herself with another man ever again. How about that?
James Woods, what did you do to get a sense of this guy, of his ego, his confidence, and his lack of conscience?
But by the way, one of the ironies of that scene, for people who haven't seen the movie in quite a while, is that the character I'm talking to, that Franklin Seals played, Jimmy Lee Smith, had just had sex with Greg's girlfriend in the scene before, and I'm telling him about what a sexual maestro I am and so on, and how she could never imagine herself with another guy. And of course, an hour before, he has, of course, been with her. And it's one of the ironies of the scene about this guy's, you know, he's such a blowhard and, of course, you know, doesn't know anything about what's really going on. That character was fascinating to me because he actually would put on a fake Southern accent, and it was hard to do because, as you notice, it sounds kind of weird. It's not really a very good Southern accent, but he actually talked that way. He tried to be always something other than he was. And the irony, of course, from that scene is that they were stopped for having a faulty taillight, and that's when they killed Ian Campbell, the police officer, and kidnapped Carl Hettinger. And it ended up in the longest set of trials in the history of California jurisprudence, you know, trying to convict these guys. I think the resources of Joe Wamba's brilliant book, The Onion Field, which was, as he said, the thing that he felt he was put on earth to do, to write that novel. It's a Romana Clef. I mean, it's written as a true story, and it is a true story. Was so rich, and it showed so much about this guy's insane charm. And the great thing about true stories is invariably there are things that take place in those stories that you cannot imagine in real life. I mean, from the smallest detail, and we researched the film meticulously, there was a very funny scene in the picture where I turned to Jimmy Lee Smith, to the Jimmy Lee Smith character, and I go, so, you know, Jimmy, how do you like my disguise? And he says, Greg, what disguise? I go, well, look, I darken my eyebrows and I put this little mole on my earlobe, see? And of course, you know, it's like he darkened his eyebrows and put a mole on his earlobe. Well, the irony was when Carl Hettinger later describe the assailants. He said, you know, one was, you know, a black guy, you know, 5'10" or whatever, and the other was a white guy with a mole on his ear.
A lot of people say that when you're playing a bad guy, as the actor, you're not supposed to focus on what's bad about him. You're supposed to get into the guy's way of thinking, into his own self-delusions, and think about why this guy has such confidence, why he thinks he's right. Were you able to do that for this cop killer when you played him?
Well, I mean, it's a tough one because you're playing a cop killer, but I could... What I try to focus on is the fact that most killers, you know, I mean, sometimes actors, when they're not really doing their work, or if they don't maybe really have the, I know, that extra sort of indefinable thing it takes to be, to portray a character in a unique way, you know, say, oh, I'm playing a killer, so they're snarling around and so on. Well, killers aren't killing every minute of the day, you know. I mean, what they, you know, they still have to go buy groceries and get their laundry done. And, you know, I always try to think of, you know, giving a character like that a life, I mean, an entire life, the way he would think about all the everyday boring details of living his life. And then along the way, just unexpectedly, this capacity to destroy in such a horrific way just erupts. And I think that's the way it is with most sociopaths, you know. Their approach to life is, whatever's good for me is what I'll do, and whatever I need other people to do for me, I will charm them into it. You have to think about the objectives or the goals that people have in mind. You know, there's theories of acting where you talk about having a through line to a character and a super objective, and then momentary objectives throughout the beats of each scene. And the super objective of any sociopath is, how do I get everything I want all the time and pretend to be a normal citizen when I have to get other people to do it for me? And it becomes a real interesting exercise because, you know, most of us, you know, are other-directed. I mean, we, to some degree, I mean, we think about other people's feelings and the consequences of our actions involving other people and so on. And, you know, I made a little bit of a ruckus in the news lately when I actually referred to some of the sociopathic behavior of our current president. And what I meant was, you know, on a very specific level, there are times when I thought his behavior did not consider the feelings of other people or the consequences of his own action. And when I hear these, to me, disgusting liberals talking about, well, it's just consensual sex. Well, it's not consensual sex between, you know, two wonderful, exciting young kids on their way to, you know, France after 4 years of college. And yeah, they have a right to sleep together if they want. You know, it's a man cheating on his wife very publicly and humiliating her. And that, to me, is in and of itself sociopathic behavior. So, you know, I'm interested in that kind of behavior as a student of behavior, because as an actor, that's what we study. And a lot of times people will justify or rationalize behavior, but as an actor, you have to be incredibly candid and clear about what really is happening with the character, and then it's a lot easier to play it.
Did you learn anything about your approach as an actor from your role in The Onion Field?
Yeah, one of the things I think I learned is to be very detail-oriented. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that The Onion Field and Another Day in Paradise have a lot in common. They're about that world of small crime that leads to explosively much bigger crime. You know, petty thieves, you know, doing drugs or whatever, and, you know, robbing liquor stores and that kind of thing. In the case of The Onion Field, or robbing a drug clinic in the case of Another Day in Paradise. And then murder ends up being involved.
In both Another Day in Paradise and in The Onion Field, and in a lot of the sociopathic type roles that you've played, the character has to have a lot of confidence and a lot of swagger.
Right.
In part because the character is often a little deluded, and also they have to convince other people to follow them.
Well, also, don't forget, it's from his point of view, especially a sociopath, it's his world and everybody else is just paying rent.
Yeah, right.
And you have to remember
that's
his focus in life. It's like, He is a predator, and everything else is prey. And sometimes you have to seduce your prey. I mean, if you watch, you know, a lion and a Thompson gazelle, I mean, the Thompson gazelle will hop around the lion, you know, and come just almost within striking distance. And it's almost like a game of seduction between predator and prey. And, you know, sociopaths live for those moments, you know. And there are people who love to flirt with danger, you know, counterphobic people who love to be around dangerous people because it's exciting. And invariably they get, you know, caught up in the grinder.
So did you, when you started playing roles like this, did you have enough, did you have any sense of, like, big self-confidence or swagger in your own life that you could draw on, or were you just, like, studying other kinds of characters?
I tell you, that's a good question. I think when you're young, and maybe when you're young and in particular male, there's a kind of you know, there's a greater level of what I now see as a kind of manic self-confidence that comes as a way of sort of denying your fears. You know, a lot of male behavior, you know, extreme sports, you know, war, you know, a lot of aggression that comes naturally just from biological, you know, imprint, you know, of young males has to do with a kind of confidence that as you get a little older and wiser, you realize is a pretty false confidence. But confidence doesn't know whether it's true or false. You know, you just go out there and you feel it until you get that first big whack on the head with a 2x4 from life. And then you go, oh, I get it.
When you were a young actor, did you use your self-confidence and swagger to talk yourself into roles?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I used well, actually, I still do that. I don't think I've ever been sort of right for any role I ever played in the eyes of the people who are hiring me. I mean, it's so funny. I mean, to this day, I always get, oh, he's a great actor, but he's not right for the part, as if these geniuses who make the crap that you see in the theaters every week of your life, as if they would know what was right. You know what I mean? It's just unbelievable, you know. Yeah. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. You're so brilliant. You just made, you know. And then you look, you know, you open the paper. You know, I always say to people, they go, well, you know, you should pick, maybe a better role or something. I go, really? Name 5 good movies you saw last year.
Yeah.
5
yeah.
good movies. Not 5 great ones. 5 good movies. Nobody can do it. Nobody can name you 5 movies. They make 10,000 movies a year, and you can't name 5 that are any good.
James Woods, he's starring in the new movie Another Day in Paradise. It opens January 22nd in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle, and will open in more cities in February. James Woods will be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Woods. He's starring in the new movie Another Day in Paradise. He plays a career thief who becomes a mentor for a rookie thief. His other movies include The Onion Field, Salvador, Once Upon a Time in America, Videodrome, Joshua Then and Now, Ghosts of Mississippi, and Casino. What's the most extreme thing you've done to get a role that you really wanted?
The Onion Field, actually. Speaking of The Onion Field, they had already chosen another man to play the part. And they said I wasn't right because I didn't have blue eyes and blonde hair because, you know, they never heard of makeup. But I insisted that I could play the part better and blah, 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 blah. And I finally went and I said, look, I want a screen test. That's the least you can do. And I knew that Joe Wambaugh was supposed to be a very fair guy. I said, in fairness, you should give me a screen test. And he said, look, the reality is we can't afford screen tests. So together, my agent and I, like, sold a car and put the money together, and they did a screen test, and the screen test was going to last all day, and they put the camera on me first, and I did one scene, one monologue from the movie, and I knew that I'd nailed it through the roof like with a nail gun, and I finished a take. He said, okay, now next. I said, we're not doing anything next. If you can't tell by now, you'll never know. Goodbye. Good luck with your film. And I walked out knowing that they'd go, you know, because I knew that that move, more than the screen test, was going to convince Joe Wambaugh that this is a tough guy. And it was a tough move because I had a lot on the line. I mean, I was doing what every gambler does, which is, you know what? I got an 18. The dealer has a 10. Give me a hit. Give me a card. Give me the 3. I know it's coming, you know? And that's what we did.
Did you have that planned in advance? Did you know you were going to make that move?
No, actually, I didn't. It was a kind of spontaneous seat of the pants move. You know, like all great moves in life, you know, you just sort of get a wild hair up your, you know, and you just say, you know what? I'm going for it. I'm just going to go for it. I'm just right now, right at this moment, you know, it's like, you know, with a woman that you fall in love with on first sight, and you just say to her, you know what, instead of doing all that liberal, you know, fruity crap that, the sensitive man is supposed to do, instead of saying, you know, maybe we should go out to dinner, and, you know, I should listen to your problems, you say, I tell you what, how about you and I jump on a plane, go to Paris, get married, and let's go from there. What do you think, you know? And, you know, I don't know, sometimes it works.
And other times it doesn't.
Yeah, but, you know, it's only alimony.
Okay, so this got you the part in The Onion Field.
Right.
What was the scene that you did?
It was a scene where I had to hold a gun on a guy that I was thinking about killing and making the decision while I was talking to him. I was really irritated that he'd stolen some dollar bills from a dresser drawer. And it was a pretty rough scene. I pulled it off. And it's also one of the best scenes in the picture when we actually did it, because I remember thinking, well, this got me the part. I better do it pretty well when we shoot it.
Well, why don't we hear that scene?
So, Billy, my little woman says you took that roll of $1 bills I had stashed in the bedroom, Billy.
Bullshit.
Yes, it's true. She can't find it. And furthermore, I've been told you gave her a little pat on the fanny today. Now, I don't care about the pat.
We're sort of a family here. But I'd appreciate you don't make it a habit.
Greg, please.
Billy, I want my dough back.
Maybe she took it.
After all I've done for you, and you dare steal from me? Now, I know the whiskey makes you do wrong things, or I'd bust a cap in your damn head. Now, Billy, we're going to go out again tonight. Only this time, you're going to pull your own weight. And if you don't get me my money...
Thank you, sir, brother. Anything.
Jimmy, you're in. Can you drive?
Greg, like I've been away for 5 years.
Damn it, can you drive?
Yeah, I can drive. I can drive.
Well, all right then.
That's James Woods in the film The Onion Field.
Right.
So did you do it in the audition the way it sounds in the scene? Or did you rethink the scene by then?
No, actually, no. I follow the same instincts. One of the things that I do, and I think it's one of the reasons that Another Day in Paradise works so well, and it's one of the things that was refreshing for me to do as an actor, is that I you know, everybody has his or her own particular gifts as an artist. And some people have, you know, a certain quiet kind of screen presence that's very magnetic, like a Brando, for example, or De Niro at their best. And some people have a kind of frenetic energy that captivates you. I mean, like a Spencer Tracy or, you know, Al Pacino, whatever. And I think one of the things that I've been best at is making those kind of split-second decisions, and I kind of ad-lib pretty well and come up with, you know, I don't sometimes stick to the script and so on. And I think that there's a certain energy in being really free and taking chances on film. I've always believed that every scene that anytime actors talk about, well, I think this happens in their relationship or that happens, I always think, well, let's let it happen on screen. You know, it's what happens off screen is not very interesting to me. I like to have those moments happen on screen. There's a wonderful scene in Another Day in Paradise where we find out that the young girl is pregnant, that the character that Natasha plays is pregnant. And there was a little scene in a coffee shop. And Melanie gets very, very excited, you know, oh, you're having a baby, it's so wonderful. And in the scene, there was just one line where I say, okay, you know, no reason to get so excited about it, you don't have to make a big scene. It's just sort of like a little throwaway line. And Melanie and I were talking it over and doing that kind of actor's homework stuff. And she said, you know, it's kind of interesting, like, you know, we're in our 40s, we have these two young kids around, she's having a baby, we've been junkies for years, you know, I'm talking about the characters, obviously. And, you know, whatever happened with us, why didn't we have kids? And we started doing a backstory where maybe she was pregnant, maybe she had a miscarriage, and the reason she did, my character was out, you know, robbing someplace or doing a drug deal or whatever, and how they used to talk, like the two kids in the scene are talking about, oh, it'll have your eyes and my hair and all that stuff. And so while she's doing that, while she's saying, oh, I wonder whose eyes it'll have, and oh, isn't that wonderful, and she's so enthusiastic about having the baby, I start leaning over, and we had like four cameras working or something in that scene, and so it was all improvisational at that moment, and we didn't tell the kids what we're going to do, and I start really giving her like the evil eye, like, you know, what are you doing, man? You know, what are you talking about this, you know, stuff? We sort of swear in the movie, so I can't say it on the radio, but I start really kind of giving her a very tough time, and she bursts into tears and storms out, and if you watch the scene, there's a cut of Natasha, who didn't know this was coming, looking over at Vinny, who plays Bobby, just looking like, oh my God, does something just happen there that, like, you know, it was like that awful, uncomfortable moment when, like, a couple has a fight and you don't know it's coming, and all of a sudden one of them storms out and slams the door and the glass breaks, and we all go, do we miss something there? Mm-hmm. And that kind of electricity on screen, it's a very captivating film scene in the film, because nobody, even the other actors, kind of didn't know it was coming. And that kind of electricity to me is so much more interesting than that sort of cast iron pastry that gets, you know, shoveled out of the cinema bakery of the Hollywood movie industry, you know, on a weekly basis. You know, I'm so tired of reading scripts, you know, where on page 3 I know what's going to happen on page 110, you know.
Right.
In this movie, you don't know what's going to happen in the next frame, let alone the next line or the next scene. And that to me is the most exciting aspect of filmmaking.
James Woods is my guest, and his new film is called Another Day in Paradise. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. James Woods is my guest. He stars in the new movie, Another Day in Paradise. I want to ask you about your 1984 movie, Once Upon a Time in America, directed by Sergio Leone.
Right.
And this is a kind of gangster epic in which, epic in terms of the the way it's shot and the amount of time that it spans and everything, the story that it tells. It's a gangster film starring you and Robert De Niro, and it traces your friendship and your rise and fall. It begins in the early 1900s. I want to play a short scene with you and Robert De Niro in a car. Here we go.
How come you didn't tell me?
Being as I can change it. I'd already made the deal with Frankie to get rid of Joe. With a man like Frankie Minaldi, you don't say yes and then say no. I cannot take the chance to change your mind. You understand?
Well, you were right. I would have said no.
Frankie Minaldi is as big as they come. He's got the combination in the palm of his hand.
If we're not careful, he's going to have us in the palm of his hand.
You don't get nowhere alone.
I thought you were the guy that said you didn't like bosses. It sounded like a good idea then. It still is.
Let's just think about it, Noodles. They're going to ask us to come in with them. There's a lot in it for us.
Today they ask us to get rid of Joe. Tomorrow they ask me to get rid of you. Is that okay with you? Because it's not okay with me.
James Woods, I'm wondering what it was like for you to work with Robert De Niro because you seem like such different kinds of actors. Rightly or wrongly, I think of you as a very extroverted person and actor, and I think of De Niro as probably a very introverted person. You're so verbal, he seems so nonverbal off camera, you know, off
right.
screen.
Right. That was one of the great experiences of my life because he is, I think, one of the greatest actors in the history of cinema. And he is a wonderful guy personally, very devoted to the work and to his friends, a very loyal man. And we became friends and have been friends ever since. And he's a very, very intelligent guy, very perceptive about the work and about life and very sensitive man. And a lot of people think of him as very kind of introverted. His basic nature, that of a compressed, somewhat withdrawn person, or having that aura as an actor, worked very well for his character, and the more expansive nature that I sort of seem to have on screen, and I'll take your word for it, worked great for the character I played, and they were supposed to be that way. One was very introverted, and one was very extroverted, and it was kind of on-the-nose casting in that sense, and, you know, it was also an opportunity for me. I was kind of breaking out then in terms of career possibilities, you know, to be working with then, I think, what very few people would argue with you that he was at that time and has remained, you know, probably the greatest actor in movies in the world today.
Do you have different ways of preparing, and were you in conflict at all about how to prepare for the role, prepare for a scene?
Well, I think it's one of Bobby's greatest gifts that he is very non-judgmental about other actors' processes or their results and so on. He's very, very supportive of other actors. And he was very well aware of the fact that people saw him as a star, but he never acts in any way that way. In fact, just the opposite. The only time I've ever seen Bob act like a star was when he could use his power to help other actors get things they needed to make the part, better. In fact, I remember at the time, when we did the old age sequence, we were supposed to be in our late 60s, and Bob had this wonderful idea. He said, you know, you played the very successful guy at the end, and I'm the guy down and out. And he said, you ever see those successful guys have had, like, surgery, and they have, like, brand new caps, you know, for teeth? He said, they always show older guys with, you know, kind of gray, yellowy teeth. And he said, it'd be great if you had, like, brand new caps. And it was very expensive to have done, and the studio kind of didn't want to pay for it or something. And Bob actually paid for it out of his own pocket because he thought it'd be great for my character. And I mean, you know, he would never want, you know, anybody to sort of give him credit for it and so on. But that's the degree to which Bob De Niro goes to make a movie better. I mean, he's an extraordinary man, an extraordinary actor, and a great friend. And not only was it not difficult working together, it was a kind of lesson in life and in acting. I learned a lot from him.
Did you have a different process for getting in character?
We actually didn't. Believe it or not, Bob is one of those people who has a barometer for the truth of a scene. I mean, he just can't act if the scene isn't right. He just isn't able. He just sort of says, well, this feels false. He just doesn't know how to do it. And if the scene is right in the way it's kind of set up and conceived and written and the acting is going pretty well in rehearsals, he just flourishes. He's a natural. And it's not like he puts his foot down or something. He's just not very good at doing he just isn't capable of doing bad acting. He's just not capable of it. And he's just a natural when everything's right. And I have sort of the same instincts. I mean, I have a hard time saying sort of stupidly written lines. You know, I mean, one of the funniest things when you're an actor is people always come up to you and go, how do you remember all those lines? And of course, oddest thing about being an actor is that's the easiest part. And it's really easy if a scene is really beautifully written. I mean, it's you can almost have a photographic memory. And if you have trouble remembering a scene, it's probably because it's badly written. I mean, you know, bad writing is hard to remember. I mean, I'm always, like, amazed when waiters come up and they give you a list of the specials for the evening. I go, how do you remember that crap? You know, the beet juice, squid ink, pasta. I mean, I couldn't remember it to save my life, but yeah. I can remember, you know, 10 pages of Shakespeare, you know, and... you know, in the time it takes me to read it because it's so beautifully written and it makes sense and it's logical and it follows, you know? I mean, the great thing about great writing is usually what you say next after a character has spoken is what really at its apex, you know, is what your character would say in that situation, you know? And if it's great writing like David Mamet or people like that, you know, it's what the person would say, but in a tremendously eloquent, you know, inventive way.
James Woods is my guest. The story goes that you once left an answering machine message for Scorsese, for Martin Scorsese, that said, any part, any time, anywhere, any price. True story? That's
absolutely true. Absolutely true. He was doing a movie called Casino, and Bob De Niro and Joe Pesci, who are both friends of mine, and Sharon Stone were all in it and so on. I said to my agent, I said, is there anything in Casino? And she said, you know, all the big roles are taken. I don't think there's really anything in it. And I said, you know, I want to work with Marty. He had offered me a part once in another movie, and I was not available. I was already committed to another film and wasn't able contractually to do it. And, you know, everybody wants to work with the great Martin Scorsese. And I said, look, I've got to work with him. And she said, you know, he just doesn't really talk to agents much. He has his cast in mind. She said, this is one time, and I would never ordinarily recommend this, but, you know, just call him yourself because he responds to actors. And I called and left that message, and he called the next day and said, you know, I was watching Citizen Kane the other night. We're lying in bed, he and his then
You played Rory Cohn in that movie.
Yeah, I played Rory Cohn. And he said, I was watching you, and I was thinking, God, do you think we could get Jimmy Woods for Lester Diamond? And his then-girlfriend said, you know, oh, you should ask him. He said, oh, he'd probably be insulted. It's not a very big part. It's only a couple of days' work. And I said, Marty, I'd love to do it. I'd be an extra in a movie you directed, you know? He said, well, this is perfect. Come on and come aboard. And I had more fun in the 2 or 3 days I worked on that film, and Marty let me just improvise my, you know, my way through the whole part.
You played Sharon Stone's very flaky old boyfriend,
right?
In this, and very, very predictable, very bizarre behavior.
You know, there was a sequence with Sharon where she's getting married to Bobby, and she calls me on the phone from the wedding because she still has a thing for me. I was like her pimp and drug dealer in the old days, and her boyfriend that she could sort of never get over. And Marty said, you know, we should cut away to you because you just sort of hear her talking to me. And I said, well, I'd love to just be in like a little tiny thong, you know, in some like cheesy, sleazy, you know, like robe and have some nude woman, you know, with cocaine, you know, and together we're like doing all this stuff while I'm talking to her on the phone. He said, well, I said, just to show that this guy's just a total flake and doesn't really care about her, but, you know, we'll like all sociopaths, you know, charm her to death if he thinks he can get something out of it. So we got this woman to play the extra in sort of like her underwear, and I'm sitting there in this thong with my gut hanging out. It was hilarious, you know, doing coke while I'm talking to her. And Sharon got on the phone from her hotel, and I talked to her, and we shot 5 reels of film of me improvising stuff with Sharon. And Sharon was great in the improvisation. It was like all this really sexy, seductive stuff while I'm, you know, doing blow with like some cheesy stripper, right, you know, on the other. And I said to Marty, I said, why are you shooting all this? It's a cutaway. He says, I'll find a way to use it. And sure enough, he said, I love it. I love the stuff you guys are doing. And sure enough, that sequence was used as a voiceover. I mean, you do cut to me with the woman, but it was used as a voiceover instead of wedding music by Thelma Schoonmaker, Marty's magnificent editor, who's a great, great editor. And Marty, they used that whole improvisation as a voiceover motif during the entire wedding. So while she's marrying Bobby in her wedding dress and so on, you hear me talking to her on the phone about, you know, about how gorgeous she was when she was 14 and how I fell in love with her and all this other stuff, while, of course, I'm cheating on her with, you know, another woman. I mean, it was all of that sort of sleazy, crazy stuff that those characters embodied at that time.
Well, that's a great story. Why don't we hear that that narration that you're talking about, the improvisation that was used as a narrative during the wedding scene?
Can you feel my eyes on you? Can you feel me look into your heart? Can you feel me in the pit of your stomach? Can you feel me in you? In your heart? Don't make me come there. Answer me.
I love you.
But baby, do you know that I love you too?
No.
Do you know that?
Yeah. This is the best thing I can do for my life right now.
That's right.
So it's going to be okay, isn't it?
Promise.
God, I wish you all the luck in the world.
Do?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's the best thing you can do right now. I mean this. You'll have real security. Sweetheart, you're going to be situated just right in Vegas. Come on, this is great for us. You know, I'm always going to be here for you. I ain't going no place. Huh? I'm looking at you right now. I'm seeing you for the very first time right this minute. I'm seeing you. I can feel my heart click. I see you 14 years old. I see you the first second I ever saw you. I see you long-legged, a little cold, with stupid braces on your teeth.
Okay, then.
Every time I ever see you, that's what I see.
Talk to you later. Bye.
James Woods and Sharon Stone in a scene from Casino. We'll be back with James Woods after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Woods. James Woods, what were you like in high school? What do you think people knew you for?
Well, I was voted three things in high school. I was voted most likely to succeed, wittiest, and class clown. So I was like the guy who they thought was going to do really well, but also was like always, you know, like flinging pennies at Mrs. O'Leary in study hall and stuff, you know. So I was like, I was sort of a prankster, but at the same time, you know, like sort of the smartest kid in the school, but instead of being a geek, I was kind of like a prankster. So, I had a ball in high school. I just had a lot of great friends, and we had a school that actually was a very, I had like 26 kids in this little class I was in. We had a big senior class, but there was a small group of us called the academically talented, you know, it was like the smart kids or something. And they were actually pretty cool, but like of my class of 26, I mean, we all went to, you know, to Harvard, Yale, MIT, Dartmouth, Brandeis, you know, Georgetown. I mean, it was a pretty smart, wonderful group of kids who, you know, were of that baby boom generation where, you know, having a great education was a real premium that we all aspired to.
Now, I'd always heard you had these, like, incredible IQ and SAT scores, and right. I read last night that when high school, I think you got like 180 IQ and a perfect 800 score on the verbal part of the SATs and 779 on math. Are these exaggerated?
No. Actually, the 800 was on the English Comp Achievement Test, which was, this is the only thing I'm proud of. I had run through a glass door in my junior year. And
in college or high school?
No, I was actually, between the junior and senior year in high school, I had gotten a National Science Foundation grant to study linear algebra at UCLA. I went to school in Rhode Island. So I went out there for the summer, and I had this accident where I ran through a glass door, and it was before they had safety glass, and I severed everything in my right arm but the bone, all the tendons and nerves, everything. And so I was in the hospital a lot, and I had for a series of operations, and I had a cast on my arm. And when I took the English Composition Achievement Test, you know, they have the SATs or the two aptitude tests and the achievement tests, and also I took advanced placement tests for so you could skip your freshman year in college. And when I took the English Comp test, it was 80 true or false questions or multiple choice, whatever, and then a little essay. And I opened up the test, and I said to the teacher, I said, I can't do this. I'm right-handed, and my right hand's in a cast. She said, once the test is open, you got to take it. So I whipped through the 80 questions and evidently got them all right and wrote the world's shortest essay left-handed, and it looked like a four-year-old because I wrote it like I printed it in black letters, and I got an 800 on the test. So it just goes to show you that sometimes brevity is the soul of wit.
What did you say? What was your subject?
I can't remember. I can't even remember what the – I wish I had that essay still. I mean, it was literally like 10 lines long because, you know, I had so little time to do it. Everybody else was writing pages and pages, but, you know, I was writing this haiku poem on the subject that they required us to write on. I can't even remember what it was now, but I was kind of proud of the fact that, you know, that sometimes adversity is, you know, truly the mother of invention.
Was there pressure on you to do whiz kid kind of things with scores like that as opposed to acting?
Yeah, there was, but luckily because I was in a class of kids who, you know, were all national merit finalists and, you know, others had 800s on their college boards in this little class of mine, I sort of took for granted that there were a lot of other people out there with a lot of talent, and, you know, the only thing that was going to get you across the finish line, given the fact that we were truly blessed by God with his intellect, was going to be some hard work. And when I got to my freshman year at MIT, I mean, the average, I mean, there were 900 kids in my freshman class, and over 400 of them had 800s on their college board. So you say, oh, I get it. You know, it's that shocking thing that happens to every high school debutante when she goes to Hollywood and realizes that she ain't the prettiest girl in town anymore. She's one of 100,000 who have the same aspiration for the same three parts, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, going to the big city is a great leveler for all of us. And, you know, my life has been a constant journey down the road to humility. And believe me, the one thing I have learned that is my greatest asset is I have finally, ultimately learned to be humble. And it's fine to be cocky when you're young. You know, when you're young, you're supposed to be cocky and a Democrat. You know, when you're older, you're supposed to be a little wiser and a Republican, I guess. Joke.
Are there any lines either from films you've been in or films that you love and that you've always loved that really stand out in your mind? I just like examples of absolutely just great dialogue.
Well, I don't know if it's great dialogue, but I live my life by it. There's a wonderful line in Walk on the Wild Side where the guy says, I've learned three things in life, and if you know these things, you can never go wrong. Never eat food at a place called Mom's. Never play cards with a guy called Doc, and never go to bed with a woman who has more problems than you do. In which case, I'd still be a virgin, but, you know.
And favorite line of dialogue that you've said in your movies?
Just different ones. And right now I'm blanking. I sort of can't remember movies I did last year. It's weird. I don't go to watch my movies unless I'm sort of forced to, like at a premiere or something, because the exercise of seeing yourself on screen, believe it or not, is really unsettling. There is a sort of flood of narcissism that you can't help but experience that I think is very detrimental to you as a person. And I never could understand how some actors would say, you know, sort of shy away from the celebrity aspects of being, you know, a cinema star. And now I so understand it. I mean, it's like a little creepy to sort of see yourself all blown up there and, you know, kind of larger than life and so on, because, you know, the fundamental existential reality is that, you know, none of us is going to live to the year 2100. So, you know, when you face those fundamental realities, having your big honker up there on the screen, you know, 40 feet high is not really much of a solace, you know. So I try to be a little more level about the realities of life, you know.
Well, James Woods, a pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
James Woods is starring in the new movie Another Day in Paradise. It opens January 22nd in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle, and will open in more cities in February.